Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Johnson, journalist with BET, and it's my privilege to be guiding us through this community-based portion of the conversation. I think Dr. Fenton was very correct in dealing with the reality that there are multiple pillars within our community that have a level of responsibility for being involved in not just the discussions around some of the models for solutions, but even in shifting the discourse that takes place and how that discourse is managed within our community. For the sake of time, because this is an incredibly large panel, I will not be reading their bios, but would rather ask in their opening statements that they would introduce themselves and just essentially say who they're representing. And so as we start, I would like to dive right in, because I know we have a short amount of time to begin to tackle this. So much has been discussed today around numbers and federal response. There's been implications of where we need to begin seeing different factions of the community involved in perfecting methods as well as coming up with some new ones. And the church continues to be one of the areas that is brought up over and over again, so we will not start there. But what I would like to do is put us in a place. We've talked about what are the steps that we should be taking to respond to the epidemic with black men, and if you can merge into your remarks, where have you seen successes? Because I think that where we need to begin talking is about replicable models, what's working as opposed to simply pontificating on what's not. And so if we can start with Brother Marcus and go down the panel to the left.
I'll try to make this brief.
And if you're not making it brief, I'll remind you that you're not.
Thanks a lot, brother.
I love it.
Marcus Murray, Project Brotherhood, Chicago. Well, in terms of some of the successes, I agree with everything everybody was saying before. We know the problem. One of the things we could do is educate brothers. We have to get black men involved in the community. If I want to go into prison and talk to men in prison, I have to get somebody who was formerly incarcerated. So one of the things we do at Project Brotherhood is we train key stakeholders in the community. We talk to high school kids, we talk to college kids, medical residents, and we train barbers. Why? We need to know how they feel. We can assume as health professionals that they understand the disease. We go in there, we ask them, what's your knowledge, attitude, and belief? What can we do as a health professional to help bring this into the community? One of the very most important things we do in Chicago is give away free condoms. Why is this important? Around my clinic at the local Walgreens, all the condoms are locked up. We know HIV is a preventable disease if you know how to use a condom properly. It starts with stuff that simple. So just educating these men, providing condoms in barber shops and other places of business, lets people go in and access these condoms. It helps prevent the spread of HIV.
Hi, my name is Kelly Lindsay. I work at Harlem United in New York. In terms of successes, I think we heard a lot today about the additional focus that we've had on increased HIV testing and linkages to care. I think one of the things that we also know about the epidemic amongst the black community is that linkages to care aren't as high as they need to be, and retention to care is a continuing problem. And I think that certainly that is going to be one of our focuses, certainly around the healthcare reform conversation, but additionally, as we think about other ways to critically engage community health centers and other community-based organizations in the fight against HIV in the black community, better ways to reach out to individuals that are HIV positive and aren't linked to care or have fallen out of a system of care is going to be vitally important. The other part of the success that we've done is really getting a lot of information about the behaviors that are known transmitters of HIV, as well as kind of the social determinants of HIV transmission. What we haven't done a really good job of is really figuring out the emotional health behind HIV transmission. The questions around what stigma really looks like is still a big question for many of us. I know that so many of us really don't have conversations around shame, and that's a particularly important salient point amongst black gay men, where individuals that are having a homosexual identity or individuals who identify as gay or bisexual find themselves oftentimes having to hide their identity in different environments that they work within or live within going back to W.E.B. Du Bois, where he talks about a dual identity. Oftentimes, this becomes a triple identity as a black gay man, where you're going back and forth between these two identities within your professional and your social life. But also, there's another identity within those two environments where sexual identity is submerged to avoid adverse physical reactions or adverse verbal reactions. And shame is an extremely important salient point where we talk about how people internalize HIV risk, as well as when we think about alcohol and drug use amongst black men in general, and particularly gay black men.
I'm Dr. Keith Rawlings. I'm the medical director of AIDS Arms Incorporated in Dallas, Texas. One of the bigger problems that we have had as a recurring theme in this conversation today and often in the discussion around HIV is that our biggest success in this epidemic has been in the ability to keep people who have historically been dying of this disease alive and living. While we have done some in terms of preventing the transmission of this disease, those numbers have mostly either stayed steady or gone up over the last few decades. And I think the challenge for many of us who are involved in the care and delivery of services around this disease is that there has been virtually a complete disconnect between the fact that there's a growing volume of individuals, primarily in poor communities and people of color, a lack of available resources in terms of providers. I am actually rather struck that we have not discussed the fact that we have suddenly brought a whole new volume of people into care and have in no way at all increased the number of people who are supposed to be taking care of them. And most of those individuals are black, and many of them are black men. The disproportionate impact of lack of treatment in our communities, and the gentleman who was from the Southern Coalition points this out very clearly, that this is a huge problem in Texas and across the South, and in virtually every major city in the country, is that while we may be indeed approaching a time, and Dr. Fenton, I give you absolute credit for the idea of getting everyone tested, but unless there is someone to take care of that person, we are reproducing the same problems that we did in the 1980s around substance abuse, which was that we want everyone to know their status, but no one wants to be involved in the care and taking care of them. We have had a growing number of people. I live in a state that believes in the concept of incarceration. I live in Texas. And we also are a state that if we don't like what you do, we will kill you faster than any other state in this country. But the reality is that while I appreciate the fact that there is a huge effort of identification of people while in prison, most of these men have nowhere to go when they get out. While there's been a great deal of testing and a lot of acknowledgement of this, less than 12% of those prisoners coming out of the Department of Correction in Texas end up still in care on medication 6 months later. While they were in care beforehand, they're not getting these services.
Dr. Rawlings, let me interject for a second and begin to ask you, as you're wrapping up,
yes.
Where are some of the areas where, even on a small level, we're beginning to see people that are handling some of those issues in the right way, okay. And how can we begin to push to replicate those?
Well, I will use an example around incarceration. While the state has had less than 12% of its patients remaining in care 6 months later, through using a program similar to what these gentlemen have been talking about of putting individuals in the departments of correction, working with them at the point of release, we have a retention rate that is approaching 80%. Unfortunately, it is a program that is getting ready to lose its funding. And I think that the problem of being able to focus those dollars not only in just will we have enough to provide for medication, but also to provide the social service infrastructures that are necessary to continue to deal with the successes is going to be one of the challenges that we face moving forward.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is David Malbranche. I am a physician and researcher with Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, originally hailing from New York. I guess I would say one of the things that struck me this morning when listening to Dr. Hayter's presentation is how surprised, or actually not surprised, I was by that. I think being a black male in this society, and for a lot of the black men here, your comments at the end I thought were very passionate, but it for those of us that have experienced that stuff, it wasn't surprising and wasn't anything new at all. And I think one of the things that we're ignoring here, I've heard the term homophobia thrown out a lot, and I haven't heard the term racism used at all. And I think one of the things that we need to really address underlying, and if we're talking about all black men, we still can't keep our eye on this myopic focus that kind of stems from the gay civil rights movement of the 80s, where we just start talking about sexuality first. I'm not really sure what an MSM of color is, but I know for me, sexuality doesn't start my whole existence, and I didn't come out of the womb having sex. And I think what we have to think about is the trauma that a lot of black men are going through, regardless of who you sleep with or how you identify or what your intimate relationships with are at the end of the day. We have to deal with the mental health, both the facilitators of good mental health and the facilitators of bad mental health, and then also the whole issue of coping. I think we're not going to stomp out racism, poverty, disease, and homophobia in this session, not by a long shot, but what we can do is start talking about how are we going to equip our black men and young black boys with the tools, both individually, structurally, community, and family-wise, to deal with that trauma, because it's not going away, and how to live healthier existences. And I want to hear that conversation forwarded on, and I want to make sure we actually hear the voices of the black men. It's somewhat ironic that we talk about the issue of focusing on sexual behavior, sexual concurrency, all these other comments, which still to me kind of harken back to this whole issue of slavery and when a black manhood was described as to work or to breed. And so sexuality from the conception of slavery and black manhood actually started with the whole notion of sexual concurrency and breeding. So are we really surprised when we see this focus on this today? I don't think we really should be. I think we really need to kind of move the agenda forward to start talking about how we can best equip the men themselves to cope with these issues, and actually not from what we're pontificating here, but actually instead of putting the brothers up as numbers, statistics, and bar graphs and histograms, actually let's hear their voices. So actually interviewing them. And when I travel to Atlanta, and we're doing a current research project in Atlanta, Columbus, Georgia, and Valdosta, Georgia, when I tell you that going down to Columbus, Georgia, and talking to some of the brothers over there and just doing qualitative interviews, the brothers will cry during the interviews. They see it as therapy. They say that this is the first time that anyone has listened. And actually, after we did our first set of 15 interviews in 3 days down there, the response was so great. One of the female leads of the community-based organization invited us back because the interviews became the topic at the church sermon by the pastor, because three of the men in the church had actually participated in the interviews. And we were just asking a general question like, what is your life like living in Valdosta or Columbus? What are the best things in your life? What are your top priorities? These questions, if we step back, it doesn't start with HIV. It doesn't end with HIV. This stuff didn't happen overnight. So if we start to expand our minds and actually think about some of the fundamental causes and fundamental issues and priorities that are in the lives of all of us as black men, then we can start moving forward on this.
I'm Edwin Sanders. I'm the senior servant at Metropolitan Interdenominational Church in Nashville, Tennessee. First, let me say thank you, Dr. Melbranch, because the first thing I had on my list was just to say the word racism. And let me go further than just say the word. The reason why I'm very insistent that this has to be a part of the conversation is that it's a word that has been taken out of the conversation. There's a way in which you easily are dismissed. There's a way in which you easily are relegated to a position as being on the fringe of intelligence these days when you talk about it. And there's a way in which we have to be very clear about bringing that word back into the conversation. But the word has to be understood in terms of how right now what we're dealing with is systemic, institutional, and structural racism, which ends up being at the heart of many of the issues that we have raised in terms of the lack of infrastructure and in terms of the lack of capacity to be able to respond to a number of these issues. So I have to say that it's a word that we have to keep on the table. It's a word that we have to deal with, because we are not dealing as black men with this problem in isolation. It is in relationship to the larger community as well. And when you deal with the word racism and the reality of racism, it brings the entire community into the conversation in a way that allows us to be able to appreciate the breadth of responsibility that there is that goes beyond men of color, black men in particular, but rather it represents all of us, because the predicament is not driven by us in isolation. That's the first thing. The second thing that we've talked about a lot today is this whole business of incarceration. And I think we have to appreciate that we cannot talk about incarceration and the problems that are associated with the spread of this disease in relationship to that phenomena without talking about drug policy. There's a way in which the racism, which is very much an insidious part of the way in which the fueling of the prison industrial complex is now transpiring, is something that has to be addressed. It is the new Jim Crow. It is one of the ways in which we have to deal just forthrightly and honestly with the fact that it is the way in which what I call black gold is being mined in our communities, because it pays for those persons whose stock portfolios are growing every day because of their investments in these prison industrial complex systems. We have to deal with that. So when we talk about the prisons, not just testing people going in, we need to deal with the issue of the rates and the numbers of people who are going in and why they're going in. The other thing that, and Jeff, I don't know why you took the faith perspective off the table.
I didn't take it off the table. I said it wouldn't be first.
It wouldn't start first. All right. Well, it's hard for me. But Jeff, let me tell you, it's always first with me, all right?
I understand, Reverend.
We'll come back. We'll come
Thank
back.
You.
But let me say one thing, though, that I...
Give
that,
the benediction.
Okay. As a matter of fact, that's the most important part of the last word. So let me give you the last word, and we'll have to come back. I want to suggest to you, and I'm going to open this up, and we'll come back to it, is that there's a phenomenon at work within our communities that ultimately continues to perpetuate the horror that we're facing. And I refer to it as being what I call dysfunctional belief systems. It's driven by all of the negative self-image, self-concept, and realities that we deal with every day. And our buying into those concepts, the ownership of those concepts, and the way in which it translates into behavior, and the ways in which we frame our issues and our problems. And until we deal forthrightly with that, and the point is, there's nothing more powerful than what you believe. And in too many instances, what we believe about ourselves and the communities around us end up being the drivers behind the reality that is causing the horror.
Good morning. My name is Tony Wayford. I'm with the National Action Network. It was interesting, Jeff, when you read and you asked us about successes. I thought about it, and I was so glad he started at the other end, because it took me a long time to come up with something. I think it's sad because I couldn't come up with nothing. Mm-hmm. What I came up with, the fact that I guess the only success is that 30 years into the pandemic, all of us aren't infected. If we're going to be honest, we did start off saying we were going to have honest grown folk conversation. And I think if there's a success, that's the only success that we can actually claim. 30 years, over half of the epidemic, black folk, infection rate amongst women through the roof. For a man to have sex with another black man, to have sex with another man in this country as high as a third world country, we have to ask ourselves, what did we really succeed? What are we really doing? I think the only success is that we're still here. Probably another success is that we're here and right now, and hopefully that we have honest grown folk conversation, that we not particularly do what's politically say and do what's politically correct and or what's necessarily safe, but we do and we say what's right. Whether it's accepted or rejected, we have to speak from our hearts and do what's right and say what's right. And that's going to make some people uncomfortable. And to be honest with you, I didn't come this far. I'm not running for election, so I can say what I want to. My house knows reasonable. So we honestly have to talk to each other. Hey, let's get real, black people. So we have to honestly talk to each other. I would hope that we honestly have honest dialogue. I'm actually honored to be here because, again, too often, especially as a heterosexual man working HIV for the last 15 years, most of the time I'm not in this conversation. Most of the time I'm asked to do a lot of stuff on the back end, but nobody asks me my opinion on the front end. Because I, as a heterosexual black man dealing with black folk, I have to be strategic in my plan and my attack in terms of how I reach our people, because we're not monolithic. The same things and information that I have to get from Phil Wilson is different from the same things and information I have to get from Cleo Monago. And the same, which is and what I have to get from Mountain Minority AIDS Project in LA is different than both of them. And I have to talk to all three to come up with a conclusion. We can't just wrap black folk up in a bundle and figure we're going to address all the problems, because it don't work like that. And for some strange reason, we forget that. For some strange reason, we seem to think what works in West Hollywood works in South Central. That's not true. And it's because I would humbly submit, it's because we don't have honest conversation with each other. And it's hard to have honest conversations because we're going to have to agree to disagree on some things. I approach this pandemic from a perspective I'm saving black life. I don't care what you do, don't know what you do, and a lot of stuff I'm never going to understand in a million years. But that's not important to me. What's first important to me is black people, saving black people's life. We can figure that other stuff out later. Me and my wife don't agree with everything, but we ain't divorcing. And I'm sure we ain't going to agree with everything today, but I'm going to be with y'all till the wheels fall off. So that's my thing.
You know, Jeff, I said, it wasn't Jeff, it was Greg, that, you know, I like sitting on the end because you get a little room. And the other good thing about sitting on the end is that you get to hear everyone go before you. The bad part about sitting on the end is that you then realize that what you have to say is trivial compared to the incredible comments that were just said at this table by everybody here. It's been terrific to listen to what everyone has had to say. I've been scribbling notes. So I will get on with my trivial comments because I'm the media guy. And one of the questions on the agenda is, you know, the role of the media. My name is Jonathan Capehart. I'm on the editorial board of the Washington Post and a contributor to MSNBC. And I can't remember which person said it here at the table, and it was said many times at the previous panel about linkages to care. And I think part of the strategy has to be there's a need to get people to care, a need to get people to continue to care about the epidemic, about its impact on African Americans, about its impact on gay black men in particular. Last summer, thanks to Dr. Hayter, I wrote an editorial with the headline, An American Tragedy. And it was about the impact of the HIV/AIDS epidemic here in Washington. And I purposefully put the headline, not gay black men suffering from HIV/AIDS or the AIDS epidemic in the black community. It was an American tragedy. This is an American story. And I would urge everyone, as they're doing the really important work that they're doing to try to save lives, to save black folks' lives, that they look at the media as a partner. And it has to be not something that a one-off, where you get the one big story on the front page of the Washington Post, which, you know, the story about the epidemic being 3% of the population here in the district suffering from HIV/AIDS, living with HIV/AIDS, that was mind-blowing and shocking to a lot of people, certainly at the newspaper and definitely within this city. But that's one story. I think, and some folks in the audience I know have heard me say this before, it's all about building relationships with people at whatever media outlet you can get into to talk to about this story. And it's not just the news side people. It's folks who are on editorial boards, opinion writers, editors, producers, and now, you know, blogs and bloggers, folks you can talk to, folks who have column inches they need to fill, bloggers have postings that they need to do several times a day. These are people who could be, if you take the time and have the patience, be willing partners in this fight.
Jonathan, let me ask the first question by allowing you to continue the remarks,
sure.
Because the question that I have, and we're going to come back to much of what the panelists said, but because the media is a portion of what we need to cover, at what do people need to do? Because many folks can talk about the relationships that they have with people on editorial boards and can talk about the relationships that they have with producers. But if these numbers alone don't send a shockwave that says there is some level of urgency that has to be had here, even from reporting it, these editorial board members know what the numbers are, they know what the statistics are, they understand the effects of the black community. And so that whole racism thing does have to be discussed, even when we have the media conversation. So what is the strategy that must be used in engaging these folks that determine what hits the air, what stories run on the front page, if they know these statistics, but they still don't think it's a story?
Well, great question. That's why I brought up the fact that you have to have a long-term time horizon here. The Washington Post did the story. It's come back to it a few times in various iterations, but remember, if the Post does the story on Monday, it's not going to come back to it on Tuesday. It might not come back to it Wednesday. It might be another 6 months. But it's an issue. It's a matter of picking and choosing your outlets, picking and choosing the reporters and producers you want to work with. It's about building partnerships, which is very important, with people who are outside of your discipline. So, for instance, I look at the example of education. Now, it wasn't until I think you got the combination of Newt Gingrich, Al Sharpton, and Mike Bloomberg all focusing on education as the new civil rights movement, that you got people focusing on the fact that, you know, we've got to fix these damaged public schools. The same thing has to be done in the HIV/AIDS story, and in particularly it has to be done with the story related to African-American men and African-American community. You have to find articulate and attractive spokespeople, as superficial as it is, we're talking the media after all, who can be a partner with everyone to get the story out. If you get Mary J. Blige, you get Beyonce, you get Queen Latifah, you get any number of very famous African Americans, guaranteed you will get attention. It's guaranteed. But you have to find a willing and able partner.
Jeff, can I tell you
Please.
What we're doing in Project Brotherhood? I agree with what the gentleman was saying, just briefly, 30 seconds. Project Brotherhood was featured on Black in America, CNN, Today's Pioneers. We got no press. We don't look for press. We just want to save black men's lives. We got no press in the city of Chicago. An artist named Common wore one of our T-shirts on stage at a Maxwell concert. Our phone rang off the hook. It made it in the newspaper and everything. I said, damn. So everybody knows there's problems out here. We know it's racist. We know all the issues, but they don't care. So what we're doing in Project Brotherhood is we're using the internet. I can't afford to pay for an ad on BET. I can't afford to pay for an ad in Ebony. If Ebony gives me a free ad, there's an Ebony editor back there, I will do it. So what we have to do is we have to make our ads culturally specific for black folks, culturally and gender specific. Common's coming back in town. We approached him. We're going to take out our little $99 flip camera and put it on the internet and ask him to put it on his website and link it up with some of his other peers. Because if Common and these Nellies and Jay-Z's can sell gym shoes and drinks, they can definitely sell health care. So I'm not going to wait on the government to bail out black folks. I'm not going to wait on corporate America, even though they should. I'm going to go get a video camera, get a still camera, take some pictures, put it on the website, because we know that. If Common and these other artists, not just for HIV, even for other chronic diseases, because all the things, the five leading causes of death for black men are preventable. So if we give culturally and gender and age-specific messages when necessary for our seniors and our young people, we can make a difference. And then that'll put pressure on the media. The media say, oh, and these foundations, they say, oh, these folks are making a difference. Let me attach my name to it, and then the money will start flowing. So we can't wait. We have to do it ourselves.
Tony and Reverend Sanders, Tony, you mentioned that in many cases you find that you may be one of a few heterosexual men that you find involved in some of these conversations, and oftentimes you're not involved in the conversation. Mm. As we start talking about improving the response around heterosexual men in particular, what are some of the tactics that you have seen effective in bringing in not just the Commons, who may be a heterosexual celebrity, but how do you bring in heterosexual regular brothers? That can move beyond some of the stigma that exists in our community to be comfortable in being representatives around some of the HIV work and the reduction work that needs to be done?
Being honest with brothers, because again, what we don't want to face or deal with when we talk about HIV with heterosexual brothers, we carry a lot of baggage. Think about this. The reality of it is, and y'all ain't got to raise your hand, but most folk,
first time you ever had your real good climax, most of us were by ourselves. But brothers, we ain't gonna come to terms with that. And as young men discovering our sexuality, hey, you say we're gonna have grown folk talk.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people missed it all together.
Yeah, yeah, I know. As growing up as youngsters, when you're a little friend, you had a little masturbation, jack-off contest. You hump your brother, your cousin. But that's what you do as a young boy, discovering your sexuality. And what happens, and this is real. I know everybody ain't going to testify, but I'll do it, Reverend.
Go on, talk.
You know, but see, what happens is, man, in discovering our sexuality, what we do, and as you grow up, you won't get that out of your head, man, because you don't want to be necessarily considered you was a faggot or something. And brothers don't want to revisit that. And what you're doing is you're just discovering your sexuality as a kid. Ain't nothing wrong with you. You know what I mean? And you have to be honest and come to terms with yourself on that reality. Mm-hmm. And most brothers don't want to revisit that. Because the worst thing you can do in the community is be punked.
But Tony, where is that conversation happening, right?
Because there
are a lot of people
among
in this, even in this room right now, that are uncomfortable.
And I can see it, I feel it.
And so, but how do we, because this is a conversation that might be happening at the barbershop.
Right.
It's not always productive,
right.
But it's happening.
Right.
And it may be happening in some of our living rooms while we're drinking.
Right.
But where institutionally are we having this kind of conversation that leads us to a place where brothers can transition beyond it and be included into this broader movement?
Brother, I've only seen it. I mean, I've not seen it in a form, because again, when you come like this, you got to get honest, and folk don't want to get honest. Right. The success that we've had, whatever that success that we have had, has been one-on-ones. We have to meet with folk and just and run it and allow them actually to purge themselves of some of that nonsense, because the first conversation you're going to get when you're talking to a brother, especially, I don't care who they are, the major leaders and all that other stuff, people that go to the press conference and swab on camera because they got to, because it's politically correct to do that. Then talk about you on the way to the car. We have to get with folk one-on-one and let them purge themselves of some, because they got some stuff they can that they don't want to share with you. And we have to change the dialogue. Like, even like today, it broke my heart. Even in here, we talked about down low. That's a problem for me. And I'm a heterosexual man. All that does is further separate us from one another. If I say down low, you think of a brother. A black man is immoral having sex with men and women, not telling his woman. Why would we do that to ourselves? You ain't gonna think of Elton John when he was married or any of them other folk. Why would we do that to ourselves? We have to change our language. And what I try to do when talking to brothers, I change language. I'm not using the language of people that beat me down and oppress me to liberate me. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. That's not gonna happen. And we have to be honest with each other. I would argue the hardest part is us being honest with each other.
And so have any of you found, because clearly the stigma is real, but where have we begun to move beyond it and found some effective ways to bring brothers in? Because what Tony's talking about is real, and that's a whole nother discussion that has to be dealt with. But there have been some successes in bringing heterosexual brothers in that we need to hear about and try to replicate.
I missed that.
Yeah, let me just try to say a couple things on this. One is, I do think the conversation happens in barbershops, and I think the language of the barbershop is one that is still operative and works well. But I'll be very clear, the language also can be brought to the pulpit, and it can be brought to the classroom. And I think that we err in thinking that we should not put the onus of responsibility upon those who are in the pulpits and those who are in the classroom as well, because the real problem is that the issues of sexual behavior go on in the barbershop, but I've heard very few sophisticated conversations of human sexuality in a barbershop. And one of the things that happens is that in most instances, the folks who are carrying on the conversation, as you just said, are ill-prepared to be the ones that would be the purveyors of this information. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we have to come to the point where the level of priority within our community around this issue is such that whether you're heterosexual or otherwise, you talk about this. One of the things I tell people, and I use this analogy all the time, racism doesn't end until the conversation happens in a forthright, honest way when no black folk are in the room. Homophobia doesn't end until the conversation happens when there's nobody gay in the room and there are folks who speak in clear, objective terms about the reality of sexuality that manifests itself in that way. So For us, it's a matter of elevating the conversation. Let me tell you how we have done that, all right? Because you're talking about successes. Metropolitan Interdenominational Church, we've been doing this work now for 26 years. It started with education, mainly because one of our founding 12 members died from what we later found out was one of the opportunistic diseases of AIDS. Then we started doing direct services, and then we moved to the level where we did prevention, direct services, and even now to where we have one of the few of those new primary care clinics that was referred to a little while ago in our church. As a matter of fact, to show you where you can push this, is there's no reason why there shouldn't be other folks in the faith community who are talking about developing the pastors to provide primary care within the structure of their churches. Another positive is that it did not happen purely on the basis of external monies. I always tell people the best thing that ever happened to Metropolitan Church in developing our HIV/AIDS ministry is that we didn't get funded. So I have to say thank you to CDC and other folks who turned us down.
I love it.
Because we were determined that we were going to do the work. Consequently, when monies did become available, and one of the criteria was that you had some track record of doing the money, doing the work, we could raise our hands and say we've been doing it.
Right.
So you have to move it to the level of the agenda. For instance, a few years ago, this was early, this was in 1991, I made a commitment at a meeting here at the White House to mention HIV/AIDS in one way or another in every worship service that occurred at Metropolitan Church for a year. That was 52 weeks. I want you to know after about week 20, I had people coming to me saying, do we have to hear this every week? It went on, but it had a transforming effect upon our congregation. And what I'm saying is that, and also as far as I'm talking about this thing about the church, it also doesn't work, and there's some other clergy in the room, until it becomes a part of the Sunday message. It's one thing to have an announcement in your bulletin. It's another thing to bring somebody up who gives you a little statistical, epidemiological presentation. But when the pastor stands and speaks, pastoral leadership is still an awesome force in the African-American community. Because even with all the work that we do, to be quite honest, if I ask you to give you a percentage of the number of people in our congregation who fully appreciate, understand, and have an in-depth appreciation for the work we do, it's probably less than 50%. But that does not keep us from being 100% involved in doing the work, because the voice of pastoral leadership is still important. And the last point from something you said earlier is that you said you had to bring the business community, you had to bring the politicians, the educators, you know, you went down the whole list of people you have to bring to the table in this. The fact is they all come to church.
Right.
I get to talk to doctors, I get to talk to business people, I get to talk to the educators every Sunday. The issue is what's being said. And until we're able to get the message correct, to we, you know, dispel the myths, deal away, get rid of the misrepresentations, and deal with the facts and the truth. And the other thing is this whole business of you know, the politicalization of science. Look, the science is the science. And we can't stand on Sunday morning or any other place and lie about what the science tells us in terms of how we can deal with this pandemic in our communities. And we have to prepare those persons who are the messengers of our community to be able to care differently. Because guess what? My barber sits in front of me every Sunday morning. And when I talk about it on Sunday morning, I know that at least when he gets back to his pulpit, he'll have to raise his hand and correct those who are perpetuating lies and misunderstandings. So it can be done, but it's a matter of us elevating this issue to the level of priority in our community, where indeed those who are the gatekeepers and the leaders are speaking to the issue every time they get a chance.
Let me do this, because I know that there are other panels that want to remark, comment on this, but there are a couple of other areas I want to get to before we have questions from the audience. And that is one that you just mentioned, which is all of these groups come to church. But when they come to church, there isn't necessarily a strategy laid before them about how the business community can be effectively involved, or how lawyers, from a litigation standpoint, can be effectively involved. Where have some of you all seen some very sophisticated partnerships where there are very pragmatic agendas laid out for some of these partnership groups? So that as a business leader or a small business owner, even if it's me writing checks to organizations at a local level that need capacity, or using business resources to be able to spread messages, or as an attorney, you know, providing pro bono work for those that have been discriminated against based on their sexual orientation. A large number of strategies for these specific groups to be engaged. Where have you seen that be effective, and what are the specific groups that have you seen most impacted? Crickets.
I'm trying to wait. Now, I could go further.
If you have the answer, I think the bottom line is need some pragmatic recommendations on how I can engage the business community or the legal community or the medical community around building these kind of partnerships. Okay.
One of the things that we've been able to do as a result of being funded by the Centers for Disease Control to do capacity building is to help clergy to begin to talk in a frame of reference that brings the business of social determinants to the way in which they look at delivering a message around health issues, and being able to talk about it in a way that is reflective of how these issues fit within the framework of a biblical or really a textual understanding, because it's not always the Bible. Whether it's the Quran or rather it is any of the other sacred texts, you can take the principles around which we need to address this, the disease, and speak to it effectively. That's the first thing. The thing that we've done, though, is we have been able to work with clergy all over this country. In our last grant cycle, we worked in 23 states. We spent time talking about issues of how you develop the capacity for, around issues like communicating for social change, how you deal with issues like, you know, dealing with social determinants, how you deal with issues of human sexuality. So I guess what I'm saying is there's an effort afoot. There's a lot of work to be done. I'm not suggesting that we're all there, but I want you to be clear about the fact that there are some of us that are doing that work, and I think that it's going forward in a very significant way.
Who have been some of the most unique and unusual partners that you've seen brought into the circle that have been effective?
I think that probably in our business community, there has been some buy-in, especially when there are people who have found themselves eager to employ and to have young people involved in their workforces, and realizing that these issues, in a much more complicated sense than just HIV, end up being a deterrent to their ability to be able to do that and talk about how you do it. Let me just throw out this one thing to you. If you look at it on a global level, it is very significant to note that the PEPFAR initiative was much more driven by the desire of what was in the interests of national security, which had to do with the fact that people were dying at such rates in the sub-Saharan countries and other places being so heavily infected, that they decided that the labor forces were being compromised by this disease, and at that point it became of greater interest. Now, all I'm saying is we have to learn to frame the issues in a way to say
economics,
that we need to have folks in our community who have the opportunity to be a part of a vibrant labor force that are not being compromised by issues like this disease.
Certainly.
And when you start talking that way, it's interesting how people want to carry on the conversation. It's where you get to a level of conversation that is not happening in many instances. We've done that.
Mm-hmm. I would also add in three examples that have been very poignant, at least for us. Mm-hmm. The first one was in the fact that during the 2000 census, the realization that in most of our cities, the majority of the population is now non-white. And from a purely business standpoint, the population that you were now marketing to, the population that is now doing a great deal of the purchasing power, is becoming increasingly communities that are impacted by this disease. We actually had a conversation with several of the large foundations in Dallas and in larger part in Texas about how do we, from a purely business and economic model, begin to talk about issues that are impacting these communities, and have been relatively successful in getting large corporations that are, many of whom are headquartered in Dallas, to address some of their policies. The second group that I have seen one of the more successful components with has also been in relationship to our healthcare institutions, particularly the hospitals. HIV is, for a number of years, has become increasingly a disease that has moved from being an inpatient disease to an outpatient disease. And the hospitals have benefited from that dramatically in the context of having lower rates of emergency room visits and hospitalizations. In recent years, however, we have started to see an uptick in this process where hospital emergency room utilization and particularly hospital admissions have begun to grow as people are living with this disease and are now having a far more significant impact on the bottom line. As a result, partnering with these institutions that heretofore wouldn't even talk to you about HIV are now suddenly wanting to know how can you work at a community-based level, mainly to keep people out of their inpatient wards. And then the third group for me has actually been academic institutions. I actually had the opportunity to sit down with a group of HBCU presidents a few years back, and realization was actually fairly straightforward. The people who pay your salary and who come to your institution mostly look like us. Whether or not you are heterosexual, male-to-male sex, whatever kind of orientation you want to do, when I write that check, it still has to not bounce. And if when you see these institutions who are now seeing huge percentages of their populations that are at risk, both from their student population standpoint, but their alumni who are now being impacted in terms of their endowments, and it's also in terms of the parents who are now writing those checks to those institutions, the only other group of people that I think have been as responsive to this in many cases have been the clergy, because the population that tithes in the black church are still black people. And if you want to have that plate full on Sunday morning, you tend to have to address those issues. Amen. So clearly the academic institutions, not because of intellectual curiosity, but because of who writes the checks for tuition, the business community, because this is the population that growingly is what we are marketing to, the medical community, because it is truly driving their cost in ways that is becoming particularly prohibitive. And I think those three examples are places where not only you are able to engage, but you're starting to get people's attention. They're no longer looking at you and saying, why do you want to talk about HIV? They're looking at you from a purely bottom line standpoint. When the president and CEO of one of the hospitals in Dallas, who historically has never taken care of HIV patients, comes and now wants to sit down in my office to discuss how we can help keep people out of their emergency room, gives you an indication of where this epidemic is going.
Okay. Last question, and at this point I'd like for those of you that are interested in beginning to ask questions, if you would start to line up and we'll go over the ground rules at that point. The last question I have, almost every one of you on the panel asked the question or began to talk about issues surrounding the issue of HIV, whether it was poverty, whether it was racism within the prison industrial complex, whether it was issues of access, access and opportunity. All of these things affect not only HIV, but affect the broader community. There's a great deal of debate, as we all know, over the last 18 months about whether or not the president needed a black agenda. Did he have a black agenda? What did that black agenda look like? So on and so forth. The challenge that I had in many cases from some institutional leadership, and I worked in the NAACP's national headquarters for 5 years, and we are in some of these conversations. We know that many of the people that were complaining didn't bring an agenda to the president in the first place. And so my question is, where is the institutional agenda of black folks to begin to deal with shifting public will that will change how members vote in Congress, how organizations are funded, where opportunities come from? Because if there is not a substantive agenda coming from the black community towards state and federal legislators, then the public will can't shift what these government institutions do or do not do. Where is that coming from? Who has been most effective in the last year in doing that? And where can people begin to plug into to be a part of reducing some of these other systemic problems that are affecting HIV and AIDS as well?
I don't think there's going to be one agenda, just like there isn't one black community or there isn't one big black church that everybody goes to that we talk about when we say the black church. I think what has to be done, if you want to talk about successes, just look down at the end of the table at Marcus with Project Brotherhood in Chicago. That's probably a model that I think needs to be replicated across the country, but really specifically motivated and inspired by what brothers are saying in each area, because what brothers go through in Chicago and what their healthcare needs in Chicago aren't going to be the same as Atlanta or San Francisco or Oakland or New York City. So you can use that as a template, but as a loose template, and then go from there. One of the things that I did want to say before and answer your question is that some of these unique collaborations between the media, academic institutions, community-based organizations, national, local organizations need to happen. The problem with it is that a lot of times the heads or the people that you speak to that are representing these organizations may not be the best people. And I'll give you an example. The current project I'm doing in Atlanta was written up originally as a and since we're having grown folk conversation here, this is with, it was a collaboration proposed and conceptualized with 100 Black Men of America. I spoke to two different representatives from the Health and Wellness Committee of the local chapter in Atlanta who were completely on board, wrote letters of support, everything. When we actually got the funding, those two people had moved out and a new person came in. This new person, when I said, when I was in joy and saying, we got this funding, let's go ahead and address HIV among all Black men, he said, what's in it for 100 Black Men of America? Mm-hmm. And that meant money. And the problem with this is that, you know, and this is not a damn, I'm not trying to damn 100 Black Men of America, I'm saying this was this individual. Yeah. And unfortunately, that individual was at that point to block me right at that, where as previously I had people who were working with me before. So it's about us trying to collaborate on this and reaching out with the right people. We're just as much, and I'll self-disclose too, I'm a homosexual Black man. I'm a homosexual man who is currently partnered, and I've been caring about this epidemic for years, and I'm one of the few that actually do care about heterosexual brothers as well as homosexual brothers, as well as bisexual brothers, and any other brother who decides who they want to have sex with at the end of the day. I'm concerned about you if that's the case. One of the interesting things that happened to me, and I think we have to take responsibility, particularly, and I'll call to task my homosexual brothers out here, I'm doing a project with Dr. Lisa Boleg, who is here in this audience right now, working with heterosexual men and gender role norms and scripts in Philadelphia, urban Philadelphia area. One of the former employees who was working on the grant with her took me to a barbershop because I needed a fade and took me to his cousin. I sat down in his cousin's chair. I was about to get my fade. I was really, really happy. They started talking about their wives, their girlfriends, this, that, and the other, all the drama that was going on. Oh, my girl, she's acting like this. My girl, she's my wife, da, da, da. And I started laughing. He said, why are you laughing? And I said, I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. I deal with dudes. Like, that's not in my reality. Brother man shut off his clippers, turned the chair around and looked at me and shook my hand and said, thank you for saying that.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, before we were talking about barbershop, typical barbershop conversation that was skating the surface but laden with a lot of tension of beliefs and opinions underneath, all of a sudden it cut through all that. We had some of the most rich dialogue I'd ever had in a barbershop before. But that was because I took it on myself, because my attitude is that if I'm sitting away with my heterosexual colleagues at the table and we eating dinner and they're talking about their wife or their husband and how they're about to go on a trip to Cuba, it's up to me to actually say, well, I'm going to go with my partner to Cancun next week. Could you please pass the greens? And just kind of move on with that same level of casual, because people will not nut up on your sexuality or your orientation or your placement in life if you don't nut up yourself. Right. So if you're comfortable with your stuff, it'll be able to bridge. So it's up to us to kind of reach towards each other and get these collaborations going. I look at some of the things that have happened with these collaborations, and I blame ourselves as much. I'm a huge proponent of the each one, teach one mentality. So you have to start with yourself, and you have to move forward with the table of yourself before you can actually start making these collaborations. But we need to, academic institutions, community-based organizations that traditionally dealt with homosexual men should probably reach out to the NAACP, to the fraternities, and the sororities as well, because the sisters need to be involved as well, 100 Black Men of America, so on, so on, so forth, and keep doing those as well as the media, because when I listen to, Jonathan, I think you were mentioning the people that were represented from the media, you said three women's names, and that struck me. You said Queen Latifah, Mary J. Blige, and Beyonce. And I said, where are the brothers' names? And then we finally heard Common being mentioned over here. We need to think of the brothers that are going to be at the table as well and start reaching out to all of them.
Let me do this, because we have exactly 25 minutes before we have to wrap this panel. And we've got 10 people in line now. So what I'm going to ask is that no one else gets in line, because I know some of y'all like to wait till the line gets down before you stand up. I would ask that nobody else gets in line, and I ask that you would ask your question. Please, 30 seconds, please limit 30 seconds to setting up your question, because if you have not asked your question after 30 seconds, I will ask you to ask your question. Please try to direct it to one member of the panel if you can. If it's a broad question, I would ask that only one member of the panel answer it so we have the ability to get through all the questions. Amen.
Amen.
Thank
Amen.
You so much. Yes, sir.
I'm Israel Nieves from the San Francisco Department of Health. I wanted to look, Reverend, if you could talk about how do we begin to, if we want to go upstream, how do we begin to address childhood trauma? So if we, and instead of addressing behavior now, how we take care of our children, abuse, bullying, All of those things are indicators of health around substance use, mental health. So how do we integrate that without just waiting for the message, what are you doing now? How are you taking your care of your children now?
Thank you. Reverend?
Yeah, I think that's very important. I appreciate the question. Let me just say to you, I think that one of the things we have to do is that make it clear to those who are the messengers the ways in which all these things are related to our problem. Be real clear. I mean, we are not the psychotherapists. And we, although in many instances assumed to be pastoral counselors, in many instances are not trained to be, but are effective messengers, which ends up saying to the community, these are things we have to look at and make sure we know how to make referrals and say these are the places we need to go to get the help that we need, but to make sure that somehow those issues are not somehow left out of the equation of the conversation, because in too many instances they are not, and they end up being at the heart of what perpetuates the problem. But the issue is getting those persons who are the messengers to where they are incorporating those concerns into their message. And until they have the level of understanding, the breadth of understanding, to appreciate the connectedness and the relationships, it doesn't get there. So that's where I think we have the responsibility of building capacity amongst the messengers to be able to deliver the message effectively. And those things are there in that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I've heard the word racism. I would think intra-racial racism and classism is in that as well. Coming from Baltimore, my name is Donnie Glover, BeMoreNews.com. We've seen a city, majority black city, as is D.C. We have more black politicians than ever before in the history, but yet they get maybe 60-70% of their money from outside of the community. And as you mentioned, my question is about the future. What do you foresee in the future in Baltimore with a majority black city and all of these politicians, AIDS, HIV, we used to have HERO, but HERO is gone. It's no longer.
So what specifically is the question?
Specifically, how do you remain optimistic when you get new prisons every year, but they close schools every year?
Thank you.
I can jump in on that one. And I'm coming from a perspective of growing up in Detroit, Michigan, which, of course, is another majority black city, moving to D.C., which is, of course, another majority black city, and now working in Harlem. So I think I have a pretty critical mass of black experience. And I think one of the salient points, one of the salient points that has rung true for me throughout my work, to be transparent, I started doing the work not because I had a philanthropic endeavor, but based on my own diagnosis with HIV in 2003, and I wanted to give back to the community because I felt when I grew up in a religious environment, I grew up at Hartford Memorial Baptist Church, which is a nationally, internationally recognized Baptist church. We had conversations around HIV and AIDS in the church all throughout growing up, but we never had a conversation about sexuality or homosexuality. And that was the undoing of my HIV infection. And when I look forward, I see that the landscape is changing. I see people continuing to have honest dialogue. And I see more people stepping forward and being less fearful of talking honestly and engaging in honest conversations around sexuality, around drug use, around concurrent relationships, around incarceration, around alcohol and drug use, around rape, around abuse. And what we have to do is foster environments where that can happen, meaning foster environments not only in churches, because I know we like to push all of the accountability on the church system, but we also need to create environments within our families, within our communities, within our schools, to engage in honest dialogue, to begin to uncover some of those deep-seated truths that we hold that contribute to the trauma or the stress or the demonization that many of us have spoke about. We need to be able to unlock those potentials and really bring them to bear for the success of black men.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Sure. Alvin Kwamina from AIDS Project of the East Bay in Oakland, California. I want to commend two areas of research to the panelists and to everyone else. The first is with regard to dysfunctional belief systems. I mean, clearly we've got to deal with human sexuality, but I'd like to see some research around the theology of disease more generally. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot we see at AIDS Project of the East Bay, folks who have theories of disease that having nothing to do with homosexuality or sexuality, that put them at a disadvantage in terms of treatment, in terms of feeling like this is punishment, in terms of feeling like faith is an alternative to rather than a supplement for traditional medicine.
So is that your question? Because I don't know if Reverend wants to deal with that.
That's number one.
And no, I got one. Only have time for one. So that's your question, brother. Thank you very much. Reverend?
Exactly. Oh, but I, you, 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 you really do hit the nail on the head in terms of the whole theology of disease question, because in a lot of instances we have not been able to make the connection between that which ends up being preached in terms of our faith and the complementarity of that with biomedical realities and facts. I think that when we come to the table with the level of sophistication that we should have, those two things do not end up being at odds, because I think even the biomedical world, there's an appreciation for the ways in which how one comes with a mindset or an understanding of who they are in a way that incorporates faith, it ends up being an asset to the biomedical process. But when they're talked about in terms of being one or the other, that's a lose-lose. And I'm convinced that what we have to do is come to the place where we bring that question out in a way that does not mean that there are these folks on this side of the room and those on the other side of the room, but rather that we're on the same side of the room, and that's the health and healing and the well-being of our community, and understand how those things fit together. That's kind of what I meant a little bit when I was talking about this whole business of how the politicalization of science and healthcare has undermined the ability for the conversation to go on forthrightly. We've seen that from the highest levels in this community to the lowest, and I think, and also the conversation has to happen in a way where it reaches all congregations. I should tell people all the time that there are three kinds of churches. You know, I use my good friend Will Campbell. There are high steeple churches, low steeple churches, and no steeple churches. The fact is, most of the people in our communities are at low steeple and no steeple churches. And in many instances, our ability to build the capacity to deal with the complex issues that you're talking about does not reach to that level. And we have to learn how to make sure that happens. Otherwise, the conversation is not effectively carried out.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Bobby Marvin with HewVoices.com, and my question is directed to the brother from Brotherhood. I have a question. I imagine that you work with black teenage males, trying to get them to understand the importance of HIV/AIDS. What is your method? What has been a response on educating them? Because we're fighting two diseases, not only HIV/AIDS, but also ignorance. What has been your response, and what has been your efforts with Brotherhood?
Well, everything we do at Project Brotherhood, we take a public health approach. So we don't just look at the disease. We look at the social part of it, the economical part, spiritual part. Mm-hmm. We look at everything. So one of the main things we do in working with young people, as well as old men, we tell them, get involved. You have a chance to make history. So I have to break down the disease in a way they understand. For example, we have an expressway in Chicago called Dan Ryan Expressway. So I say, who wants to run across the Dan Ryan blindfolded? I'll give you $100,000. They look at me and say, you're crazy. I say, well, that's right, I am. You having sex and not using a condom the right way is crazy. So what we do is we ask them, first, we have a focus group. We ask them that knowledge, attitude, and belief. What does HIV mean to you? What does it mean? When you hear that word, what does it mean? Once we develop and analyze what they say, then we develop a curriculum for them, a culturally specific curriculum based on what they said and based on the experience and knowledge that we have. Once that curriculum is developed, we then train them. Once we train them, we ask them. We say, look, I can't speak to your peer group. You're trained now. Let's create some signage. Mm. Let's create some messages that you could relate to your high school kids. I don't listen to Lil Wayne and some of these other guys, so I don't know the language. They do. Once you involve them, they want to help. Mm. Black men and boys, young men want to help. They want to get involved.
Thank you, brother. Yes, sir.
Cleo Monago, Black Men's Exchange, and the Amasi Centers for Wellness and Culture. I would like to use 30 seconds or less. I would like someone on the panel, or as many as possible, to define the term racism. It's an ambiguous term these days. No one knows what it means, particularly now that we don't have racism, according to some people. So I think you should break that down. The second thing I want to raise, which is rarely raised, is the issue of internalized oppression. Mm-hmm. There's people who have been in charge of this disease over the years who have self-concept issues, in my opinion, that has impacted how well or how badly this disease has been addressed over the years. And I would like the panel to try to explain to myself and the audience the literal impact on a meta level and on a macro level of internalized oppression and how it's possibly been impacted how we do HIV/AIDS services. I already know it has, and I'll walk away from the mic by saying that the Black Men's Exchange has been doing work with heterosexual men and mixed groups and bringing the community together for 20 years, and that it's not an unusual thing, as well as a lot of issues that Dr. Melbranch raised. We've been talking about them for a long time. And thank you for inviting me, Greg, because usually, though I'm not heterosexual, like you, my brother, I've also not been invited to these opportunities because I will raise the issue of race and internalized oppression.
Thank you so much. Anyone on the panel want to take that?
Let me just...
Hold on, Reverend, before you go, let me see if there's somebody else on the panel. You've been overly prolific, and we're not paying you for this, so we want to make sure that we don't abuse you. Is somebody else on the panel want to comment on that?
I guess I brought it up first. When I use the term racism, it's not the same as just having a prejudice. I think a lot of people have prejudice and preconceived notions and judgments based on race, sexual orientation, gender, class, so on and so forth. Racism I see is the kind of specific institutional and individually mediated oppression of another group based on their racial characteristics. So you're keeping another group down from any kind of upward mobility because of either that subconscious or conscious level of doing that. One of the articles that I think is really interesting that kind of uncovers the levels of racism that Cleo was talking about is Kamara Jones did an article in the American Journal of Public Health called The Gardener's Tale. And if any of you haven't read it, it's from 1997 to 98, so it's been out for a while. But it talks about levels of institutional racism, personal mediated racism, and then individual racism or internalized racism. I think what Cleo's talking about is these kind of things, and I'm glad we're having this conversation because if somebody gets pulled over by a cop, if there's a cop who's racial profiling, which by the way, in all the research I've done with homosexual, bisexual, and heterosexual brothers, always comes up, racial profiling, the cops, police brutality, these kind of things. So it's regardless. Cops aren't looking at someone, a brother in a car, and saying, he may be homosexual, I'm going to pull him over and harass him, or he may be heterosexual, I'm going to pull him over and harass him. He's looking at a brother in a car and going on from there. But I think what happens is that when you consistently get these what we call microaggressions, racial microaggressions, these micro-traumatic experiences, and particularly for Black men, and we keep hearing about it in the news, and I would also include microtrauma. I was experiencing microtrauma just seeing the stats again. That is trauma to me all the time because all I'm hearing is that I'm a statistic. I'm a number. I'm a basis of a circle. I'm part of a pie chart. Those kind of traumas build up over time that I think a lot of folks actually, regardless of class or how educated you are, internally it can become a situation where you don't think your life is as valuable as it should be. And despite of all the education, all the knowledge in the world about whether you should use a condom or not in certain situations, issues of mental health, substance abuse, those things kind of come over and you think you're not better than, or you have lower expectations of yourself because you're constantly getting these messages from the outside world that this is all you're gonna amount to. So I think when we have to deal with this, and that's why I brought up the term coping. I don't think there's an answer, and I'm not gonna propose that we're gonna stomp out racism. It's always gonna be there. I'm not gonna see that before I leave this earth. But what I think needs to be done is talking about coping, our reaction to it, so that it doesn't become an internalized part of our psyche that we transmit from generation to generation. The coping aspect is the big thing. Because when we deal with the depression, the trauma, and as well as that, the facilitators, what makes us feel healthy, what makes us feel good, once we deal with those kind of coping strategies, then we can actually incorporate those kind of things. Up to now, particularly with Black heterosexual men, it hasn't been documented in the literature that much. It's not in the literature. And as we know, when we're talking about dollars and cents and policy moving forward, things have to be in publications. Things have to be, they have to have a numerical value, a p-value, a confidence interval, statistical significance. It doesn't matter. I could tell you all the anecdotal stories till I get blue in the face. If we don't have those statistics in the publication, so the research actually has to get done. And I would encourage all of us to get more involved in research because unless we're putting it in these journals, in these publications, in these media outlets, in these blogs, and not just anecdotally, yeah, today I was on the train and something happened to me, but actually bring some numbers up, people aren't going to give us the money or think this is a real issue.
Thank you. Let me do this because we have just under 10 minutes. There's no way we're going to get all of you if we do it the way we've been doing it. What I'd like to do is have you state your question, and that's all. Please state your question, and I'd like to get all five questions in a row, and then we'll have the panelists respond. If you don't have a question, then please sit down. State your question, sir.
This one's for Mr. Capehart. What can we do to get the media to empathize and sort of, but when I say the media, I mean advertisers and marketers and everybody in the media, sort of with companies like The Gap and Starbucks, to empathize with the scourge of AIDS in African-American communities the way that they empathize with the scourge of AIDS in African communities, specifically with their dollars?
Thank you. Question, sir.
Yeah, my name is Patrick Wilson. I'm at Columbia University. My question is really, how do we have these conversations around sexuality at an earlier point in time? I think that what David said was great, and about talking about different sexualities, non-normative, non-heterosexual sexualities.
When you say earlier, what do you mean?
Early in adolescence and early in childhood, how do we have those conversations early? And I think that it's great that we are talking about
sexuality. Well, I appreciate the question. Thank you so much. I gotta get to as many as I can. Yes, sir.
How do we employ the idea, I'm going to use Reverend Sanders' term of radical inclusivity, and bring together all of the best minds and all of the diverse viewpoints together to talk about these issues? Collaborate or die. And with this issue, it's becoming literal. Great. Unless we work together, how do we do that? So how do we work with people across the aisle on this issue? Because if we want lasting change versus, you know, 4 years, 8 years.
Gotcha.
If we want lasting change, how is that going to happen with all of us?
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I'm Wakefield with the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, where when we enroll people in clinical trials, we always get contact information from their family members.
Okay.
My question is about women, because it's the female family member that allows us to remain connected with persons. And as we've had this dialogue this morning, I haven't heard us talk about where and how we bring women in the black community into this conversation.
Great, thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Douglas Brooks, GRI in Boston, and I'm also on the President's Advisory Council for HIV and AIDS. And the question I have is, where do we go from here? Where do we go from here in continuing to have these important conversations? And I would say particularly among gay-identified black men and heterosexual black men and bisexual brothers, where do we go? How do we continue to have this very, very important conversation? And they're the Kaiser, the Mac, and Ford are all in the room, and maybe they'll be willing to put some money on the table for us to do it, but how are we going to do it?
Thank you very much. So we have, how do we make advertisers? You all heard the question. I'm not going to repeat it because that's going to take more time. Jonathan. Yes, please.
So my answer is going to be very short, because even though I'm in the media, I am on the editorial side, the print side. There you are. The question you have is more of a business question. How to engage the business side of media organizations? The last public panel that the National AIDS Office did, I believe it was a month ago, was all about business collaborations and how to collaborate with business in fighting HIV/AIDS. There's a particular organization that I know a lot about, the Global Business Coalition, and it would be worthwhile to reach out to that organization and other organizations like the business organizations where there might be media companies involved. In short, that's the only answer I could have for you, again, because I'm on the editorial side and not the business advertising marketing side.
When you look at it in terms of what you said about Starbucks, and the whole issue of why focus on an international issue versus a domestic issue. The fact is, when you focus on the international issue, you distance yourself from it in a way where it's a right thing to do, but I'm not really a part of the problem. You deal with it domestically, especially in terms of all the things we've said about race and racism. The fact is, you cannot deal with the problem without seeing yourself as being a part of it. And that's not comfortable for people to do. And just quickly, in terms of the issue of sexuality.
Well, that was the next question,
yeah.
So please.
I just want to say one of the things that we make a tremendous mistake with is the thinking that somehow people somehow don't differentiate between sexual behavior and sexuality. You know, how we act out our sexual selves in interpersonal relations is one thing. Sexuality is something that needs to happen from, you know, that you can talk about in terms of the child, the minute it comes out of the womb and begins to identify in relationship even to mother and father in ways that are very much driven by sexuality. Has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with a dimension of who we are, you know, as human beings. And because we don't differentiate and separate the two, it's very hard, very often, for the conversation to go forward. Because people say, well, we want to start talking to our kids about having sex when they're, you know, in preschool. But you can start talking about sexuality in preschool. And
Let me add on to that. Yeah. I think an intervention, this just came to mind, because I thought about how a lot of parents, and I'm in the South right now, and being from New York, and then being brought to schools, grade schools, where the kids are asking about where does sperm come from, and the principal shutting me down as I'm about to give the answer to the kids. What I think needs to happen is the interventions don't have to happen actually with the children, but have to happen with the parents. Mm-hmm. So we actually have to have interventions that involve either it'll be dyads like mother and father or same gender couples, and how do we empower parents to start these conversations earlier, because it has to start within the family. I don't know if there's going to be like a broad paintbrush that we can sweep to say, how are we going to have the conversations earlier? And what I'd like to see from the church is, I would challenge the churches, instead of having the HIV ministry, which happens after folks are getting HIV, is actually to have a sexuality ministry. And when I say sexuality, I don't mean homosexuality. I mean sexuality on a broader scale. So talk about sexuality in all its facets and all its terms, not just homosexuality. That's been the problem, is that we think of these sexuality curriculum, sexuality ministries, and we've just talked about homosexuality, and that's as myopic and as one-sided as just going from the heterosexual norm.
This is going to be the last comment, and I would like whoever wants to take this to merge these three. Because there was a conversation. the question was, how do we make women a part of this conversation? But that speaks to the collaborate or die piece, because if women are not a part of this conversation, then there's not that level of collaboration. And that speaks to the where do we go from here piece. So whoever is brilliant enough to do that within the next 90 seconds, please, by all means.
90 seconds. I think the collaboration of sisters in this conversation is the same thing that's happened across our entire history. If we do not work together, it does not succeed. And the reality in collaborations, whether or not it's in our institutions, talking to our children, or whomever, both of us, male and female, have to be involved in that conversation. Where do we go from here? Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be at the national level. This is a conversation that has morphed primarily into a state and local level process. As someone who was grew up in Baltimore and for years has practiced there, if we're not having those conversations at the level of City Hall and at the state legislature, the national dialogues, frankly, are just not going to get there. And the main reason for that is because where the funding of this exists now is mainly at the state level. It has increasingly become the state's determination of where we will go. And bringing the business community and the state governments into the same conversation, frankly, is going to be the place where we have to move. And I would challenge us to also say that while we like to talk about this as a disease of young people, there are more people over the age of 50 with this disease than there are under the age of 20. And the conversations that need to be happening with our children, frankly, have never happened with ourselves. We need to be having more conversations in our older community in order to reach into the younger communities. Basically, our kids know about HIV way more so than their parents. And we are, in many cases, deluding ourselves into believing that that is not where this epidemic is going to be going in the future.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for that brilliant 90-second response. It is now officially 12:15.
Can I give
which
them a benediction?
No, sir. as a licensed minister in the AME Church, I'll be giving the benediction, sir. I would like to say that to the brother's last comment, to Pfizer and to all those in the room with checkbooks, let's talk about a national tour of For Brothers Only that begins to get down at the national level and talk about HIV and sexuality the way Tony would talk about it, having some very closed door, honest, no media discussions that allow brothers and stakeholders to be very forthright and honest about what they're saying, but allow us to get some real data on the back end of it that can be effectively used in what we're talking about doing. I know there are enough people in this room that would be interested in something like that. So that would be my one recommendation as the moderator. I'd like to thank you for inviting me to lead this dynamic discussion. Please give our panelists a round of applause, and thank you very much.